Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Psalms chapter 9, the title to which says this, "For the director of music to the tune of the death of the sun, to the tune of a song called, quote unquote, the death of the sun, a psalm of David." Once again, we're doing a Davidic psalm, which we have seen all the way from Psalm number 2 all the way to Psalm number 9. This psalm was to be sung to a certain tune. The tune went with a song called The Death of the Sun. That song is unknown, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Sounds like a strange name for a song to me, The Death of the Sun. Doesn't sound very positive. This psalm, on the other hand, is very positive. In fact, I will call the psalm, I will recount your wonderful deeds. So this is a positive psalm. Now, Psalm 9 and Psalm number 10 may have originally been a single poem split out in our English translations. This is the NIV Study Bible. And also, this single poem might have been an acrostic poem where each line of the poem started out with a successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet, like A, B, C, D, the Hebrew equivalents thereof, and each line starts with that letter. In the Septuagint, as a matter of fact, in the Greek translation, Psalms 9 and 10 are one poem. So we start now in Psalms 9, verses 1 through 6. David says this, "I will give thanks to the Lord with all my heart. I will tell of all your wonders." He's speaking directly first person to God. He says, "I will give thanks to the Lord with all my heart." What does that mean? Does that mean with mere mental singing he will sing in his heart, i.e. to himself? Don't think so. John Gill says it's vocal singing. Quote, "The word here used for praise signifies to confess, to speak out, to declare openly the praises of God in the public congregation, as David elsewhere determines to do." So in verse 1 where it says, "I will give thanks" or "I will give praise," that word is not talking about private praise in one's heart mentally. Now, Gill says this open praise is done in the public congregation. I don't see why you couldn't also say it was David privately speaking openly with his mouth, not keeping it quiet inside his brain. But I think Gill is probably right that most often the giving of thanks that David has done, he's thinking about in the public congregation around the tabernacle. John Gill says of giving thanks with all of your heart or all of David's heart, "Sometimes God has nothing of the heart in worship. It is removed far from him and gone after other objects." Yeah, it's like you're supposed to be singing a hymn in church and you're thinking about the baseball game last night, that kind of thing. That's not with all your heart. But when you give thanks to God with all your heart, it's with your whole-souled devotion, your full attention, with your eye on God and nothing else. And so David says, "I will tell of all your wonders." That could be wonders of creation, maybe God's miraculous deliverances in David's life, of which there were many, maybe even God's forgiveness because of the sins that David committed. Verse 2, David says, "I will be glad and exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High." God is high and he's most high. There's nobody higher than him. And again, singing praises to your name means singing praises because of the wonderful and excellent attributes of God, not singing praise to a set of letters like capital Y, capital H, capital W, capital H, Yahweh. He's not singing praise to a name. He's singing praise to who God really is. Verse 3, "When my enemies turn back, they stumble and perish before you." David is really concerned about his enemies, as I've pointed out as we've gone through the first 9 Psalms here, first 8 Psalms. David is very worried about his enemies, and he loves to see them beaten. And so here he says his enemies will stumble and perish. Verse 4, "Why? Because you have maintained my just cause." Not just his cause, but his just cause. He stands for what's right, for what's godly, not that which is idolatrous. At the end of verse 4, David says, "You have sat on the throne judging righteously." And that, of course, would refer to judging David's enemies. God's taking care of them. Verse 5, "You have rebuked the nations." That probably refers to the Canaanite nations who were ultimately driven out of the land. David had some part to do with that, of course. He mainly knocked out the Philistines at the end. David continues, "You, God, have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever." Now, there's a little problem here. The wicked's name has not been literally blotted out forever. We still know of all kinds of wicked people, unfortunately. And if you just talk about the name rather than the actual people themselves, the name of the Philistines is still around. We're still talking about them, even if they aren't, even if the people aren't. But David says in verse 5, you, God, have blotted out the nation's name forever and ever. Well, it can't mean that God has blotted out even the very memory of the nations, the name of the nations, because as I said, we still have the names of the Canaanite nations and the Philistines. Well, how do you solve this problem? Here's a couple of optional solutions. First option from the NIV Study Bible. David is speaking of redemptive history, not history in general. So when the nations have their names blotted out, their names are blotted out from salvation history. They're not going to get saved. They're not going to be delivered by God. They're going to be destroyed. Another way to solve this problem is by saying that the nations have their good names blotted out forever. You have blotted out their name. That would mean blotted out their reputation, their good name forever and ever. And of course, that's true. That would work too. As John Gill says, their names continue, but with a scandal and reproach upon them forever. All right, so the name of the wicked is Kaputsky. How long? Forever and ever. Now, you know when you ever see that phrase, forever, in the Old Testament, it can either mean, it's olam, the Hebrew word olam. It can either mean forever and ever in the sense of eternally with no gaps and with no end, or it could just mean for a long time until something happens. Well, here it means literally forever and ever. You have to go by the context, and of course, God is eternal, and he has blotted out the names of the enemies of God forever and ever, eternally, at least from the sense of eternal going forward, of course, not backwards, because they didn't exist at some time in the past. Only God does that. But from the time of their existence, the Canaanites and so forth, they have been blotted out forever and ever until the end of time, world without end. Here's what Adam Clark says here. Olam has its proper signification, without end. He who contends it means only a limited time, let him tell us where the Hivites, Perizzites, Jebusites, etc. now dwell. And when is it likely they are to be restored to Canaan? Where they're not going to be. So they're gone, gone, gone. They're not coming. They're gone with the wind. They ain't coming back again. We go down to Psalms 9, verses 7 through 10. David continues, but the Lord abides forever, as opposed to the temporary existence of the nations, which David just mentioned. God lives forever, eternally, with no gap or stop in time, obviously, for the same reason, context. Well, God has to live eternally, forever and ever. He has established his throne for judgment, and he will judge the world in righteousness. Now, when will he judge the world? There's a couple of options there. It could refer to the universal judgment at the end of time, as John Gill suggests, or it could be that God judges along and along throughout human history. But whenever it is, and I believe it's all through human history as well as at the end, I believe it's both of those options, he will do it in righteousness, which means that no one will get what they don't deserve. There is no perfect righteousness on this planet. As we live, we have to wait until the end till we see all justice done, no sin left unpunished, no good deed left unrewarded. Now, when it says God will judge the world, that world there does not mean a physical planet, the earth. It's a general name for all the countries of the inhabited world or the habitable world. David continues at the end of verse 8, God will execute judgment for the peoples with equity. Verse 9, with equity. Verse 9, the Lord also will be a stronghold for the oppressed. That word stronghold is a high place, as Adam Clark says. That's where no enemy can reach nor see. One, if you're way up on top of a mountain, you can't climb the mountain, you can hardly even see the people up there. And so this is a great picture of how God protects weak people who are oppressed. And Christians have been oppressed for all the history of the church. It's happening here in America, but it's really already happened, for example, in China, in the Middle East. God will be a stronghold for all Christians. Good application there. He will be a stronghold in times of trouble. And note that not all of our times are troublous. Sometimes are troublous. Verse 10, and those who know your name will put their trust in you. For you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. God has not forsaken seekers of him. nor will he ever do so. This reminds me of one of my favorite verses, Hebrews 13:5. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. Let's talk about money. He's not going to let you starve to death with no money. So there's therefore no need to love money. Let's look at Deuteronomy 31:6. Moses said, be strong and courageous, Israelites. Don't be terrified or afraid of them, the nations, the Canaanites, etc. For it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you or forsake you. Leave out the intermediate words. He will not forsake you. Psalm 37:28. For the Lord loves justice and does not forsake his godly ones. They are preserved forever, but the descendants of the wicked will be cut off. Folks, if you put your trust in Jesus, Jesus will never forsake you. Yahweh will never forsake you. Psalms 94:14, for the Lord will not abandon his people, nor will he forsake his inheritance. Application there should be obvious. We go to Psalms 9, verses 11 through 14. David says, sing to the Lord who dwells in Zion. Proclaim his deeds among the nations. For the one who seeks an accounting for bloodshed remembers them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted. Be gracious to me, Lord. Consider my affliction at the hands of those who hate me. Lift me up from the gates of death, so that I may declare all your praises. I will rejoice in your salvation within the gates of daughter Zion. You see all this praising going on here? That's why it's so ironic that the song called The Death of the Son is the tune by which this psalm is sung. Must have been a good tune. But the words aren't there because the words are, praise God, praise God, praise God. Now, verse 11, David says, sing to Yahweh who dwells in Zion. I've given a pretty good rundown of Zion in the audio covering Psalms chapter 1. But just briefly, Zion is a common metaphor for the people of God in whom God dwells. Psalms 2:6, but as for me, I've installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. That's where God dwells. Hebrews 12:22, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God. That's Christians the author is speaking to. You have come to Mount Zion, so Mount Zion is the home of the people of God, both New Testament as well as Old Testament. The heavenly Jerusalem that comes down out of heaven, that's the church, the people of God. So sing to the Lord who dwells in Zion. He dwells in Zion, and also his people dwell in Zion. He dwells together with his people. Remember in the city of David, David put that tabernacle there, and he put the ark in there, and that's where God lived in that ark, and that's where the people came, represented by the high priest who came in to visit that ark. So God dwelled in Zion, and the people dwell in Zion with him. Proclaim his deeds, David says, among the nations. That shows that God working in history is important as an aspect of the praise of God. For the one who seeks an accounting for bloodshed remembers them. Remembers whom? Remembers all the nations who have oppressed those who have retreated to the stronghold of the Lord for safety in times of trouble. Proclaim his deeds among the nations in verse 11, verse 12. It shows that David is thinking particularly about God's judgment of evil that's done among the nations. Verse 12, for the one who seeks an accounting for bloodshed remembers them, remembers the nations, because God is a God of justice as well as a God of mercy. I wish Adam Clark would emphasize that more in his commentaries. He seeks an accounting for bloodshed. In other words, people who do evil, God's looking out for that. He's watching them. He's going to pay them back. It's going to happen. If we had more fear of the justice of God, maybe people would do less egregiously awful sins. I mean, it's no coincidence that those who are trying to transition from their God-given gender to their other gender, and then these people who are making up about 100,000 different kinds of genders, those who say that men can marry men and women can marry women, for the most part, they have turned their back on God and they do not believe God and they hate Christians. Not all of them hate Christians, but a lot of them do, because Christians stand for what God wants his people to do. Christians stand for the fact that God created them male and female, and to start messing around with God's created genders is the ultimate way of spitting in God's face, of shooting God the bird. And that's blasphemous, and God's not going to let people get away for that. God seeks an accounting for bloodshed, for those who kill, those who murder. Are you listening, Vladimir Putin? God will account for evil people in the nations who are oppressing the innocent. He took care of Pol Pot. He took care of Mao Zedong. He took care of Joseph Stalin. He took care of Adolf Hitler. And he's going to take care of Xi Jinping. And he's going to take care of the people who are slaughtering babies in their wombs. All right, so in verse 12, David says that God does not forget the cry of the afflicted. Verse 13, be gracious to me, Lord. Consider my affliction at the hands of those who hate me. Once again, David is very concerned about his enemies. They're constantly oppressing him. He was a king, and kings have to deal with both internal and external enemies all the time. David says, lift me up from the gates of death. A gate is an entrance into something. So if you are at the gate of death, that means you're about to enter into death, i.e. you're about to die. And David says, keep me away from there. Lift me up from there. I want to live. In other words, the affliction that he's suffering is so bad that it threatens his life. David says in verse 14, so that I may declare all your praises. I want to be lifted up from the gates of death for a purpose, for a reason, so that I can declare your praise for delivering me from the gate of death. I will rejoice in your salvation within the gates of daughter Zion. Now that phrase, daughter Zion, is strange. The NASB has, I will rejoice in your salvation within the gates of the daughter of Zion. That's not the NASB translation, just the phrase, the daughter of Zion. And the Holman Christian Bible has the gates of daughter Zion, capital D, capital Z. Well, that's a little confusing. Let me explain that. John Gill says that it was usual with the Hebrews to represent a chief city as a mother city and the towns and villages adjacent as daughters. Well, that's his solution, but I don't think that's the most common solution. Most people say that the city is the mother and the population is the daughter, poetically speaking, figuratively speaking. So let me read you what the Cambridge commentator says about this phrase, daughter Zion, or daughter of Zion. Quote, a poetical personification of the citizens or the city as an individual. So the daughter of Zion is the population, the people of the city. And they are said to be the daughter. The city itself is said to be the mother. Continuing with the Cambridge quotation, originally Zion was thought of as the mother, the citizens collectively as her daughter. But as terms for land and people are easily interchanged, the expression came to be applied to the city itself. And thus we have the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, daughter Zion. I like the NASB translation better. Within the gates of the daughter of Zion, in other words, in the gates of the people of Jerusalem, the people being within the gates. It's just a little bit easier on my modern ears. We go down to Psalms 9, verses 15 through 20, and we will finish this audio. David continues, the nations have sunk down in the pit which they have made, in the net which they hid, their own foot has been caught. Now the nations that have sunk down, that would probably be the Canaanite nations who were opposing Israel in David's time, although some people say that David is speaking prophetically of all the nations of the world. I always tend to be conservative on that and just say, no, it's what David was talking about. Those Canaanite nations have sunk down in the pit. When people hunted animals, they put camouflaged holes in the ground so the animals would fall into them. Psalm 7:15 says, he has dug a pit and followed it out. He has dug a pit and hollowed it out and has fallen into the hole which he made. This, of course, reminds one of that old metaphor, hoisted on your own petard, like Haman in the story of Esther built a petard, a gallows, to hang Esther's uncle Mordecai on, and instead Mordecai hung Haman on it. So Haman, or Mordecai, had it carried out to hang Haman on his own petard. So Haman was hoisted, lifted up, hung on his own petard. The idea is the nations are coming after David, but instead of catching David, they're going to be caught by David's Lord. In the net which they hid, their own foot has been caught. Hunters would hang nets from trees to catch animals as they ran between the trees, as the NIV Study Bible says. The idea here is the nations, the evil nations, are going to be running after David. They're not going to see their own nets. Wham! They're going to run between the trees. The nets are going to snap shut, and they're going to be caught. Verse 16, the Lord has made himself known. He has executed judgment. In the work of his own hands, the wicked is snared. Hegeion Selah. Hegeion. Right in the middle of the text. The NIV note says that Hegeion means meditation, possibly a musical notation. And of course, Selah probably means interlude. We talked about that in chapter 1. I said I wasn't going to mention that anymore. We go to verse 17. The wicked will return to Sheol. Sheol means either the death or the grave, so it probably means to the grave. Could be to the unhappy afterlife, but the wicked will return to Sheol, even all the nations who forget God. They're going to get punished. They're not going to get away with their wickedness. Verse 18, for the needy will not always be forgotten. The needy are the same as the oppressed, the afflicted, those who are attacked by the evil people in the nations. David is sort of identifying himself with that. For the needy will not always be forgotten. As I said, well, I've already quoted those verses, those four verses, Old Testament and New Testament verses, but God will never leave you nor forsake you. Similar idea here, verse 18, for the needy will not always be forgotten. In other words, they will never be forgotten. Nor the hope of the afflicted perish forever. The hope of the afflicted might perish for a little while, but not forever, because they're going to be raised up. Verse 19, arise, O Lord, do not let man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. Now, we're going from prediction to prayer here. Don't let these evil nations prevail. But he starts out in a very positive tone. He says, God, I know you're going to do this. You're going to judge the wicked, so let it happen. He prays what he expects to happen. Verse 20, put them in fear, O Lord. Let the nations know that they are but men. Men as opposed to God. Big contrast. So the needy will not always be forgotten, i.e. they will never be forgotten. The needy and the afflicted may be forgotten by man, but never by God. Remember Matthew 5:5, Jesus at the Sermon on the Mount said, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And on that positive note, we are finished with Psalms 9. So in our next audio, we are ready to go to Psalms 10, verses 1 through 18, and we will look at the problem of Deus Absconditus, the hidden God. We'll call the next Psalm 10, Why Do You Hide Yourself? I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.